So it is part of the function of this one to speak about current events in the world of samsara, the world of multiplicity, illusion, suffering, egocentricity, and the self-deception of the false consciousness. And so, because events are accelerating at a rapid pace, in particular because of the events now happening in Palestine and Israel, and extending into Lebanon and involving Syria and Egypt, and probably soon extending beyond that as well, with the potential of this event, this war, triggering that famous expression based on a certain mountain in the state of Israel. Actually, the mountain, it's really not a mountain, it's more like a hill, but it's called Har Megiddo. It's near Mount Carmel, actually. But it's a well-known phrase that Armageddon would be the beginning of the final war, the attack on that region. And this may be that moment in real time when this final event that will ignite a global conflagration is underway. Now, for satyogis, this event really should simply be a message that the timeline between now and the Omega point is much shorter than you probably thought it was. In other words, the good Lord has decided to take the lost souls of samsara out of their misery sooner rather than later. And therefore, it must be understood ultimately as a blessing. However, the ego will not see it that way in general. And so we must understand the situation from more than one level of consciousness if we are going to help people to deal with the very extreme emotions that events like this tend to stir up. And although we can analyze this event in the way that the, let's call them the ordinary political analysts do, by asking such questions as qui bono, who benefits, follow the money, what is the intention underlying this event for the hegemon, what powers are behind the scenes responsible for pulling the strings of this, and for trying to figure it out on that level. But if we don't contextualize the event from the level of non-duality, from that level in which we recognize that there is one supreme power who is in control of the unfoldment of this theodrama, one God, one intelligence that has the power to determine how events unfold, not those intermediary middle management types that think they have power within the phenomenal plane, but who are actually instruments, often unconsciously, of a much higher power and even of higher intermediary powers and principalities, because there are many levels to this event from within the samsaric perspective, but also from, we could say, an archetypal perspective. So when we attempt to understand this event, we must recognize the flow of energy that is happening from the highest level through the intermediaries and the final apparent outcome, which at the level of the ego, you will never really know. You may have your theories as to who is the hidden hand moving this. Was it that this was the only thing, the only sort of event that could take the media to completely and immediately forget about Ukraine, you know, which is no doubt the case. You know, if you want to get the media to forget that you've just lost a war, you start another one that you know that at least the whole Western world will be totally focused on. And the fact that you may not be giving any more money or weapons to your old champion, and now you have a new champion, will enable you to save face. So that's one level of it. And then on another level, we could say, but there are powers that, of course, would take advantage of the fact that Israel is at its weakest point, and it's been in the middle of nearly a civil war. There's a complete internal fracture. And most of the ordinary analysts are saying, oh, this was the worst lapse of intelligence, a failure, etc. And then you have other analysts saying, but wait a minute, Egypt said they warned Israel many times that something big was about to happen, and they were ignored, and, you know, et cetera. And there are rumors that Hamas troops are using weapons, U.S. weapons sold to Ukraine that somehow got smuggled into Hamas. If that's the case, do you think a rogue colonel was able to put a container to Egypt that got smuggled in, or was this not green-lighted by some much higher level of lokic authority? But you could argue the motives and the means of a number of states, whether it's Israel itself needing to bring unity and to deal with an intractable situation that it could no longer manage without a very massive military, perhaps even war crime type activity? Or is this a crime of other parties taking advantage of that weakness, or both? A coming together of a perfect storm of criminal intentions on all parts to take advantage of a situation that seemed ripe for a shift in the balance of power. Regardless of that, let's go back to basics for a moment. You know, the Buddhists are always saying, well, at least the Mahayana Buddhists, and from the Heart Sutra onward, that samsara and nirvana are one. Right? Samsara really is nirvana. Nirvana really is samsara. Now, who is it who would understand that? Who would recognize it? Would the samsaric ego realize that samsara and nirvana are one? If it did, it wouldn't be the samsaric ego. The samsaric ego, by definition, sees only samsara. It can't recognize the presence of nirvana, and without trying to explain further what that actually means. But is it the nirvanic self that sees it? No, the nirvanic self has always known that, but It's not a self that has mandated the consciousness of the realization of the oneness, but in fact has brought about the illusion of the separation and the difference between samsara and nirvana. So there must be a missing third. And this missing third is very important because the one recognizing that samsara and nirvana are one must be a level of consciousness that's not identified with samsara, but neither is it entirely in nirvana. It's in an in-between state. And that betweenness, that level of consciousness, we tend to refer to as the soul. So in the spiritual process of awakening, the first thing that has to happen for the consciousness that is seeking liberation is that it has to begin to recognize that its own ego's thoughts and desires and attitudes and drives, its ego's mental, emotional apparatus is operating independently of its own will, of the consciousness that is witnessing it. Until there is that moment when your own ego is dystonic to you. In other words, you recognize that somehow your ego is sabotaging you. You don't really want what your thoughts tell you you want. It's only in that moment that you realize the ego doesn't actually have free will, because it seems to have free will. It can do whatever or try at least to do whatever it decides. But often those decisions go against the grain of another aspect of one's consciousness that says, but wait a minute, I know I should be doing something different. And that creates anxiety. That's when one no longer feels at home in one's skin. One begins to feel that one is betraying oneself, sabotaging what should be one's destiny, because one's ego algorithms will not stop repeating the same drive for homeostasis, for remaining as you were with the old patterns and comfort zone, etc. So it's only when there's a recognition by consciousness that its own ego is not its friend. It's a mechanism that is working against it. That it can't. It's buddhi, the buddhi which belongs to the soul, not to the ego, has a chance to awaken. It doesn't often happen. It often happens that one simply decides that, well, I have a conflict within myself, but it's two parts of the ego that are in conflict. It doesn't recognize that there's a soul level of consciousness. And because it doesn't recognize that its soul can awaken fully to the realization that it's not the ego, nor the body, nor any of the aspects of its life that it has identified with, that it can then modify the conditioning and begin to see reality, to perceive it in a different way. The third eye can open. And it's the soul that can recognize the oneness of nirvana, non-duality, or let's say the all-pervading presence of God, or if you're a Buddhist, of the Buddha nature. Take your pick on your terminology. But there's an awareness of a much larger intelligence that the soul can attune to. If the soul is not awakened, then the attunement or atonement for the ego's self-sabotaging you and your being deceived into letting the ego impersonate you and control and keep you in a state of bondage as a soul, you can never free yourself. So the freedom that is our inherent nature can only come with the full awakening of the soul to the fact that the ego is functioning as a blinder, as a veil. It's not protecting you, it's not defending the soul, it is no longer useful. It's an obsolete mechanism that was buffering your vulnerability to being affected by the external other. But the ego can never recognize that that other is a projection, that how your world appears to you is caused by forces from a higher and a deeper inner level that are projecting points of view, attitudes, beliefs about the other and about their intentions and about the nature of the world that are coming from a place that is not under the control of the ego, nor is it determined by the ego's logic or rationality to the extent that it has a coherent ability to think. But when the Buddha awakens, that coherence is then possible. And then the Buddha, when it has fully awakened and recognized that the ego is now an obstacle to its full self-realization, God-realization, that's when the ego directs the moth to dive into the flame. The ego won't dive into the flame. Only the soul can do that and hold the ego in the flame long enough for the ego to burn. It is this sacrifice of all of the egoic patterns of thinking and of emotional reaction, only when they have been completely incinerated and the sanskaras, the predispositions, no longer arise. Only when all of that has been burned in the sacred fire of God consciousness by silencing the mind and not allowing it to erupt with its reactivity and surrendering one's will and one's heart and one's intelligence to God, as we are commanded to do in every religious tradition. Only then, once the consciousness has become the flame, will there be the capacity to understand what is happening from God's perspective. So for one who is on the spiritual path, it is the attainment of this that is the, should be, the highest priority, not obsession with what is happening in the phenomenal plane, because you will then become enmeshed in more karma, because the ego will pick sides and the ego will externalize itself and become addicted to reading the news and trying to figure out which conspiracies are doing what, and one will lose touch with one's real essence. It will be a diversion that will take you off of the spiritual path. So we need to reach that point where we can understand it without being obsessed by it, and without making false assumptions that the ego will necessarily make because it will have identified with one party or another to any conflict. And will not recognize, in the same way that an audience member at a world wrestling match will not recognize that both wrestlers are paid by the same manager, the same boss, and that the wrestling match has been choreographed, and these two opponents are either good friends and drinking buddies, or even if they hate each other, they're still following the script, because otherwise they'd be fired, right? So there is a script, there is a game, there is a theodrama, there is a genius underlying all of this, but it's not any of the intermediary beings who think they're so smart that they can arrange to have power and control and to win victories over an opponent, etc. All of that is part of the illusion, the delusion, and the hubris of the ego that has not been humbled by its own recognition of its lack even of free will or control of its own mind, let alone of events happening within the phenomenal plane. So once we understand that, and we understand that to get to a high enough level of consciousness to be able to see the full panorama of what is unfolding, which is a much higher altitude than Har Megiddo or even Mount Kailash, one has to be in that state in which nirvana and samsara are indeed recognized as a unity. And also Shiva and Shakti recognized as a unity. And all of this as a play of light and awareness. And the recognition that this play has symbolic value in the same way that if you were watching a great Shakespearean drama or some other well-written cinematic masterpiece, you would understand that the unfoldment of the drama involving suspense and gain and loss to increase one's identification with the protagonists was there to actually give you a symbolic message that didn't really have to do with the events of the fictional unfoldment of the dramatic phenomenon, but that it was to get one to become conscious of a higher level of meaning that was instilled within an unfoldment of events from an intersubjective level of consciousness in which the significance of what is occurring apparently on the stage of the world has to do with that which is happening within the micro-political battlefield of your own consciousness. And so let's experience this event as a teaching rather than a catastrophe or an impending disastrous unfoldment of the apocalypse. Even though at the phenomenal plane it may be exactly that. And the reason for that is, if you understand that this is not just a play, but it's also a kind of a video game. It's a play in which, indeed, there's no free will at the level of the ego, which follows the script. But at the level of the soul, that missing third between God and the ego, at that level, there is a degree of freedom. There's no freedom at the ego level, and the supreme level is so free, it's beyond the world and has no real interest in the events of the world because it's beyond time and space, and all of this is simply a light show that is an instantaneous thought. There's no actual distance between the alpha point and the omega point. As soon, again, there will be no distance between them for those who are within the cycle of time. But if you understand it from the soul level, what this means is your soul playing this game has very little time left to win the game, to gain victory. If victory in the game is your goal, victory meaning the complete freedom from the bondage of false identification and the absorption of your consciousness back into the source, God, the real, the absolute, before the end of the game. Because if you don't achieve the victory now, while alive, then your soul, with whatever remaining sanskaras, to whatever level of consciousness you have risen to, that will be your starting point in the next cycle. So you are determining your own destiny. You're either able to graduate from the game now at this last moment, or you will have to repeat it. Game over, but it'll start again. But where it will start will be where you left off in your spiritual evolution. You cannot start off in a higher state than the one you left in. Okay? Once you understand that, and you understand that time is short, then what this event means for the soul is something very different than what it means for the ego. You'll have an entirely different value system. And then your focus on the urgency of attaining jivan mukti, liberation while alive, release into your Buddha nature, complete elimination of all the sanskaras that are object-seeking, that cause you to remain enmeshed in duality. Only if all of that is gone and the consciousness has realized itself in the midst of the illusion will there be the ability to graduate from the game. And that's the question that you have to ask yourself. Now you see, because of this event, the red lights are flashing, game is nearly over, what will you as a soul do? If you're in the ego level, you may, you know, volunteer to rush to Israel or to Palestine or to Lebanon or, you know, in some way, join the fray. There are people who do that out of patriotic or religious or mercenary motivations. But if you're functioning at a soul level, then what will be your focus and where will your compassion go and where will your wisdom take you and where will your intelligence lead you to open up to what would actually be the highest use of your embodiment during these last moments, a use that would increase your level of consciousness and your manifestation of divine samskaras, of self-divinization, rather than the defilement of falling into the egoic chaos incoherence of the phenomenal plane of multiplicity. So I hope that all yogis will use this as an opportunity to redouble your efforts to bring about your liberation so that you can spread vibrational frequencies of peace and of upliftment of consciousness. Because remember, there is not only the phenomenal plane as the apparent field of a multiplicity of separated egos that can't communicate with each other because they have different paradigms and different loyalties and speak different languages, etc. But there is also a morphogenic field in which we are all connected as a single network of consciousnesses that are all unified within the field and that all derive their intelligence from a single source. And it's only when we are living at that virtual, not the actual level of reality, that we begin to be open to the power that a God-infused soul has to affect the morphogenic level of reality and bring about effects of synchronicity and of magic of various kinds that can't be understood at the level of cause and effect from the phenomenal plane, a level of logic. And that functions, when it does function properly, in attunement with the Tao, or the will of God, to be an instrument of service of God in these final days, which is the only means of undoing all the past karma that is the burden being carried by every soul by surrendering its entire will to the will of God. That's the purification that takes place as the second phase after the ego has been eliminated by being burned in the sacred Agni, the flame of God consciousness. And so once this is recognized, that our quest is vertical, not horizontal, that if you want to bring peace to the world, you have to recognize the world is a dream, and it can only be redreamed from a higher level. But every ego is living within a dream, within a dream, within a dream, because you have God's dream, the soul's dream, and the ego's dream, and the ego itself is fragmented into dissociated particles of itself that have different dreams and attitudes and desires. And one day we'll see one person who they are relating to as the good object, and the next day they're the bad object. Someone looks attractive to you one day, and the same person, identical, the next day looks repulsive. And one has no control over the oscillation of one's feelings because they are coming from a subconscious fund of fantasies that, until the ego and its sanskaras have been eliminated, the conscious mind has zero control over. It's a pawn in a game. And it's the sensor in the ego that has the power to determine what you will perceive and what you will deny or suppress or reject or etc. So your conscious mind does not have control over its capacity to think or perceive, and can only see the projections that are coming from a subconscious level of its own being. And it cannot download the superconscious level of its intelligence. So when we're dealing with this event that is accelerating the process leading to the omega point, unless we recognize that one consciousness, one intelligence, and one heart is actually the experiencer within everyone. Your ego is not experiencing reality. The thinking process is not truly a process that is conscious. It only seems conscious because your consciousness has misidentified with that level of the dream, and then it feels like it's reality. Once there is a fission from all of those projections, then there can be a fusion with the real, and there can be freedom. So the consciousness must understand and must grok this at such a deep level that only the one self is actually living through every seeming actor and actant in the play. The ego is not a true agent. It has no free will. And the soul's degree of freedom is only the freedom to sacrifice the ego and be reabsorbed into God through love. That's the only freedom. It doesn't have freedom at this level. But once it has done that, then filled with God consciousness can have an effect on the morphogenic field, which will have an effect on the phenomenal plane and on the way in which the world ends, whether with suffering or in bliss. And that's the gift that we can offer by transmitting that vibrational frequency of mahasukha, of great joy, of great realization that all of this is a blessing, not a horror, which is how it looks to the ego when you see bloody dead bodies on the sidewalk in various places and bombs going off destroying Gaza City, and you see terrorists of all kinds and battles being fought between people who should be able to get along and to live in harmony but cannot because they are at a false level of consciousness, but that this is part of a play and there is no one actually suffering. And this is impossible for the ego to get. The ego will say, oh, you're heartless, Shunyamurti. How can you say that no one is suffering? It's obvious many are suffering. Well, it's not as obvious as you think, because you're assuming that what you perceive with the ego eyes is what is happening in the level of the being of those whose bodies are being suddenly eliminated and their consciousness is freed to return to the source and recognize that they were never the body that was apparently in pain and in mortal straits of whatever sort. But it's the recognition that that is, in fact, an illusion, which you can only recognize once you have gotten out of the illusion. If you are still identified with the body, and when the body is in pain, you suffer, you haven't gotten out of the illusion. The bodies will be in pain. Every body is liable to be in pain now and then, or chronically, or in whatever way have symptoms based on past karma. But the question is, are you suffering as well as recognizing the body's state? And are you identified with the body, or are you recognizing that your job is not to make the body survive as long as possible? Your job is to reach the highest state of consciousness in the time that the will of God determines when your life in a particular body will end. And until there is surrender to the will of God and the recognition of who is really in charge, which is certainly not any of those in the apparent governments of the world, most of which now in the West at least are either people with dementia or they're literal idiots or fools or people who have no understanding of how to deal with foreign or domestic policy. But you also know that the governments have understood very clearly since this pandemic that a certain medical intervention was not actually safe and effective, but had an entirely different purpose. And if you ask why a government would deliberately weaken its own armed forces by having them undergo certain processes that would not strengthen their immune systems, but actually have negative effects, and why they would subject their entire population, in fact, to such an extraordinary negative form of treatment that would seem, from certainly some perspectives, to be criminal, then you can understand what are the implications of that. And that governments do not have their own people's well-being in the forefront of their intentions, nor even the intention of maintaining the government's and the state's power and survivability. That what is happening now goes against all of what common sense would say should be the motivations of the people who seem to be in charge, which therefore gives rise to the understanding that, well, these people aren't making the decisions. You know, governments don't just use mind control on the populations. They themselves are the first ones who are mind controlled. And who is controlling their minds, you see? And is it just a deep state that's a cabal of political insiders and billionaires, et cetera, or is it some other power? But regardless of whichever conspiracy that you're inclined to buy into, there is only one ultimate power. And that's the one that yogis should be focusing on, not any of those intermediary principalities that are involved as part of the unfoldment of the script of this cosmic drama, and begin to fall into paranoia or into some egoic state of intention to try to save a situation from within the phenomenal plane of action and communication, etc. It doesn't happen from that level. It can only happen from the higher level that any real effect, and that effect can only happen if it is the will of God for it to happen. And because God is good and merciful and does have all of our interests at heart, because God is ultimately the one who is the essence of our being, and all of this is a game of solitaire, ultimately, at that level, one can recognize that it is when one has attained that same solitude of the solitary God and has recognized the multiplicity as simply a reflection of all of the infinite aspects and facets of that diamond mind that is capable of inventing such an unfolding cosmos, and a refolding of that cosmos back into itself once all the secrets of its significance have been revealed to those who have become ready to not only recognize but realize the ultimate truth, that it is ultimate truth itself. Once you have attuned to it and become it, that is the ultimate solution to the problem. and the ultimate end to war and conflict and pain and suffering of all kinds for all the characters in the drama, since all are manifestations of the One. And you are that One, which is something that every one can say. But can you reach the One and recognize that that One is yourself? Only then is there victory in the game. So I hope that's understood, because that's the key. And it requires the most subtle possible discernment of the intellect to be able to realize this. The most subtle capacity to know the true answer of who am I. And if you're at all identified with the thinking apparatus of the ego, you cannot figure it out. You're using the wrong tool for the job. It's only after you have stilled all of the agitations of the ego mind that the Buddha mind, mind of the awakened soul, can open to Allah, to Shakti, to the energy and its Nivritti wave that is now returning us to the source of Paramashiva, to the absolute Godhead, that one can function to bring about a harmonious rather than a chaotic and disturbing suffering mode of exit from the play, but an exit in glory, in rapture, in the joy of return to our real being, to our source, to our creator. And only if the love as well as the wisdom of the heart, of the soul, have opened up, so that that adoration overrides any of the concerns of the ego for survival. But it also should open up the Buddhi to make use of these last moments to maximize the chances that you will achieve liberation in the time that remains by acting in a way that will put you in an environment that will be not perhaps in a war zone or in an area of immediate destruction, but also in an energy field that will uplift your consciousness and that will encourage and help to enable the freeing of your consciousness from its false identifications. So those are the real messages that I take from this event and have been called to share with you. But I think it's very likely that in the coming days this conflict will expand on a number of fronts, and there's a very high chance that it will involve the use of nuclear weapons, and that will very likely involve drawing in more of those states with such powers on one side or another. And this conflagration could easily suck in nearly all the powers that are involved in the current conflict between power blocks that will bring about a very swift end to the age. But it's also the case that nature is going to chime in, and don't be surprised if super volcanoes go off here and there, and you know, earthquakes and tsunamis and all sorts of other events in this perfect storm that will be part of the grand finale of this fireworks show that we're in. If you've ever been in a fireworks show, you know at the end, everything goes off, right? They pull out all the stops. So we're about to see a really incredible display of divine power, and not simply of human power, and not only of destructive power, but also of angelic power and divine power. Both of them will reach their maximum in a very short time. And the question is, where are you in this? Which power are you serving and receiving? And how much of it? And are you ready to make use of this final moment before the grand egress from the phenomenal plane of all souls to have reached God consciousness and function at that level? Or at least at the level of one who is a server of God and whose karma is being released through one's altruistic dedication to the service of the Supreme Power, until non-duality has been realized. So that's my take on what we should focus on during these, what could be in fact the final days of this world, and to make use of it as beings, as bodhisattvas who have completed our own inner journey and are here only for service, out of compassion, out of love, out of recognition of the oneness, and see God in all beings, and only God, and not any of those intermediary or lower forces, because they are unreal. No matter how powerful they may seem at the moment, they are unreal. And to bring that supreme real power into this plane. So that's it. I have no more to say for this evening. But if there are comments or questions, please go to the mic. Feel free to ask or to speak about anything. And if there's anyone on Zoom with a question or comment, please, I will do the best that this instrument can to give a reply.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Well, I feel very taken by what you're speaking. And what I recognize is that this part where you're speaking about the ego doesn't have a free will. I've just... over time just become so aware of these habits and patterns that I just more and more clearly see that they're just being acted out, and it's Yeah, now I see it, but I've been so involved in them, I didn't even see them. Mm. One of them is that I have become aware that when I go back to my bhavan in the afternoon, there's a lot of anxiety that comes up. I find it very difficult to relax. Mm. And I think it can be traced to not wanting to be alone, mm-hmm. and abandonment. Mm-hmm. And I can see the distractions that, mm-hmm. that take over to avoid those feelings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And those feelings have no reality to it. They are fantasies.
Yes, I see them like as this wall of thoughts that mm-hmm. we have been talking about, and the enchanted garden that is just there. It's just an illusion in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, I mean, I'm kind of a practical person. What would you recommend me to do when I go back to
okay, this is phase one. Remember, I said that the first thing is that your ego becomes dystonic. You don't like it. You realize
yes.
it's your enemy.
Yes.
You don't need to feel anxiety, and you haven't been abandoned, and it's good to be alone. You know, when mm. you're with others, you want to be alone. You're happy to go to your bhavan.
Mm-hmm.
But the ego is never happy where it is. It always wants to be somewhere else, and in a different situation, right? That's the problem with the ego. It can never be happy, okay? Mm-hmm. But what you have to do to go to phase two of the spiritual process is realize you are not the ego. Mm-hmm. It's not you who are experiencing anxiety. The anxiety is the result of your identification with those thoughts, right? Once you realize those aren't my thoughts, those are thoughts I had as a child, you know, when I maybe needed adults and worried about being abandoned or that happened in other traumatic events in the past, but that's not the situation now. All is well. I'm glad to have solitude. I wish I had more free time. And why am I, you know, spending it in anxiety instead of bliss and study and learning and meditating and realizing God, right? So as soon as you understand that it's not simply a conflict within the ego, within two different desires, it's a conflict between the soul and the ego. And then establishing yourself in the soul, disidentifying from the ego's thoughts, the anxiety will go.
Mm.
As soon as you disidentify completely from the ego's, I'm abandoned, I'm alone, I wish I had this person here or that, right? As soon as you recognize those thoughts are ridiculous and all is perfect, you can silence the mind, and that silencing will bring peace. And you'll realize, oh, I'm actually at peace all the time. It's just when I identify with the ego's thoughts, I fall into it. So then you can establish yourself in soul consciousness. And once you have done that, then you can focus on achieving stillness for such a long period that the ego is literally dissolved. And then all that is left is God. And then your heart will also open to love of God and say, that I have abandoned God. That's the real cause of anxiety, because that's the one who can give me strength and love and joy that no one else here can give me. They'll just suck my energy and make me more anxious, but God will bring peace and light and love and fulfillment. So that's when the soul will want to be completely reabsorbed in the infinite self and be done with it. So when you get past the first stage, the second is very easy to go past into the third and final liberation. But you do have to make that fission of soul from ego in order to have fusion with God. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you very
much. Thank you. You asked a very important question that has universal relevance to anyone who's still in ego consciousness. So I appreciate it. And blessings for liberation.
Thank you.
Is there anyone with a question on Zoom? No? Yeah, okay.
Thank you very much for this paradigm that is a very peace-inducing and filled with acceptance. I find it very, very useful. So my question, actually, I had the same question. Maybe my question was more about fission, and you just responded it so beautifully. I did want to just clarify one little thing about what you responded to, Nirmala, because you said in a recent teaching that it is through the, what was it, the use of the, it's kind of a reprogramming of the mind that one has to do. I don't remember the exact words, but to me it was like the use of the buddhi maybe to recalibrate, maybe is the word you use, the manas, so the ahankar can be completely dissolved.
Yes.
And I thought that was... that's what I understood from what you just responded to Nirmala, and it's where the jnana comes in, right? It seems to me all of these teachings and the information that you provide us with is precisely giving us this knowledge that then is not just about writing it in a notebook, but one has to reflect on it, understand it, and use it when one feels anxious or depressed or hopeless or whatever it is, to remember everything you just told us. So
right.
Very, very useful.
But remember, the ego can't remember it. The ego censors it. Mm. It doesn't want to remember.
Mm-hmm.
It wants, in fact, your soul to forget.
Mm-hmm.
It wants you to forget you are a soul.
Mm-hmm.
It wants to bring you back into identification with the body and therefore with the biological family, as those are the ones who brought me into being and I owe my loyalty only to the biologicals or one's country or one's religion or anything on the phenomenal plane, but not one's real self, not God. So it is this deviation from our true relationship to the source of our being because of the false loyalties of the ego that then also creates symptoms of karma, whether it's anxiety or it's some other more gross symptom in the body or in one's life that produces more of that sense of alienation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is there to awaken you.
Mm-hmm.
So when there is realization, yes, the first thing that has to be done is stilling the mind to stop the manas, and then you're receiving information. The shakti that you receive at a soul level is also, it's not just power and light and or even just love, it's information, it's wisdom, it's vijnana, okay? And when you understand that, then you realize there actually is no external world. It really is a dream, and the dream is simply information that your imagination is filling out as if it's an actual world full of people and things and planets and galaxies and all of that. But it's actually only information that is being imaginarized in that form.
Mm-hmm.
It's the implicate order that the mind turns into an explicate order. Mm-hmm. When you're in deep sleep, you're back in the implicate. There is no explicate order. It doesn't exist. And so its reality is only imaginal. It is not real because it comes and it goes. And quantum physics agrees that if there's no observer, then there's only a probability wave, but no collapsing of the wave into an actual particle or event or world. And so it's very important to recognize that all of it is a product of your own imagination, right? And, there's a famous painting by René Magritte, which is a painting of a tobacco pipe, right? A smoking mm-hmm. pipe with the words, ce n'est pas une pipe, right? This is not a pipe, right? Very famous, one of his early paintings. Well, what does that mean? The naive person will look at it and say, why does it say it's not a pipe? It's obviously a pipe, you know, I recognize it. Well, no, it's an image of a pipe. Mm-hmm. Not a pipe. Mm-hmm. The same with the world. We think I'm living in a real world. No, you're living in an image of a world, a holographic image that also has the ability to create the feeling of solidity, even though quantum physics tells us, no, everything is really 99.999% space, and nothing is actually solid. It's only the energy fields of these collapsed wave functions that are creating all of the seeming effects of a world that resists and that has its own existence outside of your own will and your own imagination. But none of that is really true. And so when you recognize that the source of your world is your own intelligence, your own consciousness, and the way it is interpreting the information that it is filled with, then one is able to have make a real difference in the way not only that your ego functions, but in the way that world unfolds for you at the soul level, but then for you at the God level, right? The ultimate level, depending on who you realize that you are. So that's why that question, who am I, is of such essential importance to answer accurately, and not just with a belief about it, but with a realization. Because the more one recognizes oneself as that ultimate source, the more power one has to redream the dream.
Beautiful. Thank you. I had another question, but maybe sure. I'll wait on it.
No, go ahead.
Well, it has to do with sanskaras, because you've been speaking about sanskaras mm-hmm. in many of the last teachings, right? That's what we need to burn in the fire of yoga, and many other references you've made to it. And of course, we understand them as these impulses that we carry and that make us act in ways that we don't understand mm-hmm. and that are more powerful than our apparent ego will, right? Mm-hmm. But today you spoke about divine sanskaras. Mm-hmm. And so my question is if you could speak more to understanding the divine sanskaras, and how does one attune to them? Does one have to let go completely and burn all of the ego? Mm-hmm. Is there a period, like the intermediate period, where you can see the ego sanskaras, but you can already perhaps attune to the divine ones or feel them or understand them, just kind of the process of mm-hmm. of reaching or of realizing and yeah. being in that.
Uh-huh. No, yeah, this is a very good question. The ego sanskaras are object-seeking mm-hmm. and object-interpreting. Mm-hmm. You are a good object or a bad object. I like you, I don't like you. I want to be closer, or I want to, you know, run away. Right? Mm-hmm. These predispositions, I believe you, I don't believe you, whether you're cynical or you're naive or whatever you are, which you could be both mm-hmm. cynical and naive, but those predispositions regarding others, information, regarding one's paradigm of belief, one's capacity for and tolerance for uncertainty and indeterminacy and not knowing and delayed gratification, right? All of those are within the relative field of the ego sanskaras. The divine sanskaras that the soul can be endowed with will only come when the soul has fully awakened and has dived into the flame and become the flame. Mm. They are actually the sanskaras of the flame, of the divine nature, right? Which have that resonance with God consciousness that creates a purity of heart and of goodness and of compassion and of recognition of the divine in all beings, etc., and a power to remain without falling into subject-object duality. And this is always depicted as a halo or an energy field of light that one has become enlightened, right? Or one has become filled with that divine power and radiance that others will perceive at some level, because one's energy is now transmitting an entirely different vibrational frequency that's uncanny to those who are not in it, and who will receive information that their sensor cannot defend against, because it comes from a much subtler level of being that cannot be blocked out, at least temporarily, in the presence of a sage who is of that caliber. But those sanskaras can only be established in the second phase after the ego sanskaras have been removed, because those predispositions to see everything as subject-object separation and the world as a field of desire and repulsion, good and bad, right and wrong, right, dark and light, the whole way that people are trying to understand every event, that is the essence of what is false. All is really a unified consciousness that integrates the light and the dark and all the dualities into one. So that divine sanskara comes as the gift of grace after one has made the sacrifice of the ego out of love for God.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Those are important questions.
To be a strong sense of connection between the teaching you gave today and last Wednesday, dying while alive, becoming the Jivan Mukti. Is it reasonable to assume that as global events now become increasingly overwhelming and difficult for the collective ego, that this will also occur on the personal level of the ego? In recent days, there have been breakthroughs in the distillation of the I thoughts and its narratives. However, after these breakthroughs, new narratives have come back with a vengeance.
Yes, of course. It's a battle. This is what the Bhagavad Gita was symbolizing long ago, that we would be in such a battle. And the question is, are we on the side of God or on the side of the ego, which is, at the end of Kali Yuga, somewhat demonic in its tendency both to be intimidated and to be corruptible and to be biased in favor of its own predispositions of loyalty that are forms of partial love rather than total unconditional love. And so the love of the ego, because it's for one person or one family or one religious group or one country, and everyone else is demonized, it creates that continual mutual demonization, which is the essence of the demonic tendency. And so, you can't divide the world that way into the good guys and the bad guys. And in the same way, the sanskaras are going to arise that will create disharmony between your ego and your soul, because the ego is always going to be involved in some internal conflict that it will project as an external conflict, because the feeling of conflict between ego and superego is so unbearable that it wants to get one or the other of those figures externalized so they can you can blame that one for your problems and get away from it, because you can't run away from it as long as it's internal. But you discover that you are haunted by it, and you may have gotten away from one projection of a bad object or a punishing superego, but you will soon get captured by another one. And so these sanskaras cannot be defeated at the level of the ego itself, because it's a participant within this this dual game between ego, superego types of internal voices and forces. So the only way, because all of your sanskaras, all the nigredo, all the darkest levels of the ego have to come up at the end if you're going to purify your soul of your ego. All of it has to be revealed to you from the subconscious. All the horror of the fantasies of the subconscious before you can attune to the superconscious. So indeed, the sanskaras coming up are a good thing. They're a blessing. Don't be upset about that. But what you must do is to recognize it for what it is, see the whole pattern, and disidentify from it completely. The awareness that you are as a soul does not think. There is an intuitive knowing. It functions at the vijnana level. In other words, it doesn't have to figure things out. It knows. But at the ego level, there's mental chatter, trying to figure it out and having theories about it. But the only knowledge will come at that level of the soul when you don't buy into any of the ego's thought forms. And only then will you be free of the illusionary agency of the ego that wants to act against its apparent enemy or to support its cause or its belief system. You will not escape that delusion until you're at the level where you see that this internal duality that projects an external one is completely false and is alien to who you are. And then it will be burned in the fire of truth and dissolved. But let it all come up, but don't identify with anything that does arise. And it's through non-identification with all the thoughts that arise, including the good ones that you think are thoughts of compassion or whatever. Don't identify with any of it. And then you will find freedom from it and liberation. Okay? Kalyan.
Thank you so much for tonight's class. I feel like it's really helped me a lot. I feel like I really needed it to be pulled out of the horizontal horror that's unfolding. Mm-hmm. It's been really testing me, I feel. And I didn't realize it until the class, as you kind of put things into a vertical perspective. Mm-hmm. Because it's been so easy to get caught up in all of this.
Sure.
And feel the emotions and start to take sides and all of the things that you mentioned. There was a few things that let's see if I can remember to see how I can explain them. But one of the things that you said, one of the things I notice as I'm watching these just terrible things happen, and the videos and the stories, is that I've noticed I can't seem to feel hate or some aggression for the quote-unquote terrorist or the other side, mm-hmm. even though there's acts of horror being committed.
On both sides.
Exactly.
Right.
It's not one-sided. There's no winner in this.
Right.
And in fact, I was thinking the only way you can win is if they both lose.
Which they will. Which yeah. all will have to lose in order for God to win.
So I was thinking about this tonight, and not like I feel like I can't feel hate for you know, the ones that are beheading babies and killing everyone in the just all the things that we've been watching, and I feel almost guilty not feeling that hate, you know, and it's of course ridiculous to even think that. And tonight it kind of came to me when you said, you mentioned the bodhisattvas, we're here to love. There's no other reason. We're here to love. And I'm not saying that I'm putting myself in some bodhisattva, I'm not calling myself that. But what I guess I was thinking about, it's easy to sit on a computer screen on the other side of the world in an ashram to see that happening and say, oh, I don't feel hate for them. You know, I think it would be very different if I was there in that situation. That would be a real test.
And born as a Palestinian in Gaza, suffering under that situation.
Or even just in New York or Chicago in the protests that are happening, I think I would get sucked right into it, you know. Mm-hmm. What it made me realize is the real battlefield is just here, right here in this community. Can I just interact with people without feeling hate? I mean, no one here is like going around cutting off heads or throwing bombs or stabbing or whatever, you know.
Heads
just
of lettuce,
like a little projection here and there, and like all of a sudden hate comes up. This is the battlefield. Mm-hmm. And that's what it kind of made me think about tonight. One of the things to take away from this. And the other thing that you mentioned that caught my attention was you were saying that both sides, both parties, they should be able to get along. I mean, it's ridiculous. They're mm-hmm. they're literally blood brothers. If you go back, mm-hmm. not that far in time, and I guess what hit me tonight, and you said very clearly, it's because of the level of consciousness. I mean, that's. It just really sunk in for me. What I realized is they're not going to get along. It's not going to happen. I don't mean to be like a pessimist, but how is someone going to forgive? Families aren't going to forgive the other side for some of the things that are happening. You just don't get over that so easily unless you change your consciousness.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I just, it kind of felt this like this hopelessness, like, It's not going to end unless it ends.
Mm-hmm.
And that just really hit me tonight, that it's going to take a shift in consciousness, not a peace rally or any of the other things.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I see myself getting caught in this horizontal drama, and the emotions come up, it's just like I can see it's a confirmation of accepting the beliefs that I was raised in, and mm-hmm. all of the how I was taught to think, taught to believe, all of mm-hmm.
It's an ideology that you are
indoctrinations, thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a lot of... it's still kind of fresh and coming in as I'm speaking now, but I just really appreciated the different perspective, of course, that you always share and you always bring. So, yeah, thank you.
Good. Well, I'm glad it has opened your mind and heart, and I'm glad you don't feel hate. That's a very good sign. And love is what it is all about. And so that's the solution. There is only one God, whether you call him Elohim or Allah or Shakti or Buddha. There's only one. And this is what I have always loved about the Sufis and their attempt to influence Islam by the great ones. They have been Arabi and Rumi and the ones the poets were reading, is that they have said very clearly, ours is a religion of love, not a religion of legality and belief in jihad of a kind of conquest for a belief system, but for love that recognizes the same God in the synagogue and in the mosque in the pagoda or wherever, and that in the tavern and everywhere, right? So it's that recognition that love is our duty, not combat and violence and killing for Christ or Allah or for Moses or for whoever. We are not commanded to kill. Quite the contrary. My reading of the Ten Commandments is "Thou shalt not kill," and that's what we are to follow. So everyone is breaking with the real commandment that all religions have promulgated, which is the law of love. And that's what we have to return to. But we can only return to it if we reach the consciousness of that which is real, our soul in relation to God, not the ego in relation to the external other, and that has been mind-controlled into demonizing that other. Okay, so thank you, Kalyan. Okay, well, we're over time, so we will adjourn for this evening. How many found this useful? Okay. So the reason that I put TBA on a lot of the evenings this week is that if events unfold in an even more accelerated way, I may come and inflict myself on you again, because I do want to encourage everyone to make use of this time, and as it begins to appear that there's even less of it than you imagine there is after hearing what I've said tonight, then I want us I think just in the nick of time, we're about to have this rainy season retreat, but even before it officially begins, those of you who are ready and willing to focus on becoming one with God and being free of the ego illusion, let's make that happen, because we are designed to make that happen when our soul is awakened and the power and the grace will be given to everyone who wishes that liberation out of love. Love for God and love for God's creation without taking sides. That's the principle of our attitude toward the unfoldment of this divine drama, that all signify aspects of the one self. And everyone, regardless of their position in whatever conflicts, everyone is actually acting out of love. But it's a limited love. It's love for one people, not for all peoples, or it's love for one belief system, but hatred of another. And our love has to be total, infinite, unconditional, and absolute, and that is liberation. So blessings for realizing that what you are, in essence, is in fact that divine love. Namaste. Namaste.